With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, everybody. Trish Wood here, and this is On the Fringe, Hour 2. Hour 1 was Greg Simons from Uppsala University talking about propaganda, which seems to be the thing that is running the world right now. Nobody tells us the truth about anything ever, except here on TNT and my podcast and a few other places like Substack. But we live in a world where information is kind of bifurcated, right? We have our own world of people that we listen to and trust, and the voices on the other side. And I believe this is true because I am an investigative journalist, that legacy media lies about a whole bunch of stuff. And I don't know if they intentionally do. I really don't understand the dynamic. I get asked that question a lot. People say, you know, you were a reasonably well-known internationally television investigative journalist on a show like 60 Minutes. I was a host, Panorama, if you're in the UK listening to this. It's called The Fifth Estate. Look it up on Google. You can probably find some of my old pieces on there too, in which my hair is awful, really terrible news anchor hair. But I, because of that background, I did some documentaries later on too, but because of that background, people are saying, why is this happening? Why are they behaving that way? And I honestly can't tell you, except to say that J schools now, journalism schools, do require that students watch everything through the lens of social justice. So when they are in the field, they don't go in the field to report like they used to either. Everybody's a digital journalist and they sit in their basement with their jammies on, surfing the net to write their stories instead of actually going to meet people. Not completely true, but more so than ever because there's no money, right? And so the J schools are teaching students to not be objective, which is kind of a loaded word, but I can explain the difference between what they're doing and what actually happens when journalists have to make decisions about what they're going to say and how they're going to say it. You know, one is making a decision based on the actual facts of the situation and reporting it as fairly as you possibly can, regardless of your own personal views. That's what reporting is. That's what sort of balance and objectivity are. It's not on one hand this, on the other hand that. You know, you don't give Hitler a time for a comment, and then, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous, right? That's what they say objectivity is, but it's not. But what they do is that in the journalism schools, that they have a kind of a hierarchy of victims and grievances, and those things adjust how journalists are covering stories now. And you can tell by the words they use, right? If you are a woman protesting trans extremism, you are anti-trans, full stop. That's it. They use the language in the news story that the person you're protesting might use against you, right? So Trudeau called the truckers anti-vaxxers. The media called the truckers anti-vaxxers. And even though most of them actually had been vaccinated, they were protesting mandates. They weren't anti-vaxxers, right? That's how the game is played. And you'll notice in legacy media that they adopt all of these kind of totems and phrases and language of these oppressed minorities that are kind of stirred up in a little pot by their woke postmodern professors who don't believe there are actual facts in the world anymore, that there's an actual truth in the world, right? They say, oh, it's all a construct of culture or whatever, or racism or something. But that's why legacy media looks and sounds the way it does now. It's absolutely and completely failing. People are peeling off like mad. I mean, the difference between, let's say, Tucker Carlson's ratings and the highest rated show on CNN, which might be Anderson Cooper, who I think gets like maybe 500,000 and Carlson gets 5 million. I don't include Tucker Carlson as legacy media, by the way, because he's always putting himself out there in very dangerous ways. I don't always agree with Tucker, but he puts himself out there in dangerous ways. He's on fire right now, too, about the Trump indictment. So it's quite entertaining to watch him, and also sad. But so that's why you're seeing what you're seeing. There's no pretense anymore that they're covering things objectively. So just forget that. People are peeling off. And that is why these organizations, like the media and the Trusted News Initiative and all of these places, are fighting so hard to accuse everybody, not them, of being guilty of misinformation and disinformation, that they have to try to kill us because they're not doing their jobs and the people are figuring that out and moving on to Substack and Cy Hirsch, who I mentioned in the last hour over the Nord Stream story that he broke, probably the greatest living investigative journalist ever. He broke that story on Substack. Right? He said to me, Trish, I didn't even take it to the New York Times. They wouldn't have published it. Right? Because it's not with the narrative. The journalists are all with the narrative that, you know, America doesn't do bad things. Imagine that. I mean, it's just, oh, my head is spinning. So that's why media is the way it is. And I just, before we get to Dr. Amy Wax, who I'm sure has a lot to say about this, she's one of the most educated people I've had on the show. I mean, degrees from the best schools in the world. So we'll have an interesting discussion. But I just want to say this because you people know by now that I have, I stepped away from a career as a documentary producer and director, a good one, making big films, to do a podcast and shows like TNT because I was a science reporter and I felt that the there was a fake consensus kind of behind some of the COVID-19 policies, including lockdowns for one, which it turns out was true. And they were being supported by censorship through the social media who were being aggressively contacted by FBI and the NIH and other places, right? So that's where I come from. But I just want, this amazing thing happened in Toronto where I am. So we had this very, very lockdown supporting medical officer of health. So our premier of our province just kind of handed the running of our lives over to this woman named Dr. Eileen Davila. And she kept locking us down and school closures went on for a year and a half. Like we up in Canada, I know Australia and New Zealand really got hammered by heavy duty COVID policy too, but Ontario, Canada, wow, we were one of the longest in the world too. And we're all still struggling with all kinds of issues as a result of that. We got stabbings and our subways are no longer safe, major mental health crisis, suicides, drug addiction, it's all gone nuts. And nobody, of course, in the news is ascribing that to the public health policy around COVID. You know, they all predicted a mental health crisis, but no one's saying, oh, our city's out of control because of what they did, right? They're not doing that. So they never tell the truth. But anyway, so I digressed. So Dr. Eileen Davila used to wear these scarves, kind of like Deborah Birx. There's a scarf thing about these female public health people, which is maybe bad taste, but that's mean. So whatever. anyway, she wore a scarf while she was holding these news conferences in which she was announcing further and further and further tyrannical restrictions for the citizens of this province. And guess what? After all the damage those restrictions did, and they did much, much, much damage here, including in my own family. They're taking her scarf. They've taken her scarf. They've put it in a plexiglass box in a city museum. All hail Dr. Eileen Davila. Do you believe it? No one's saying, maybe we got that wrong. Maybe we should review. Maybe we should take another look at what happened, given the catastrophe that Toronto and Canada are as a result of COVID policy, but we're not doing that. We're putting their stuff in museums. So yeah, not happy about that. Anyway, I won't talk anymore because I want you to meet Dr. Amy Wax, who is a tenured professor at UPenn. I just want to repeat her academic bona fides because they're remarkable. She's both a doctor and a lawyer, not just a doctor, a neurologist, as I understand it, and a lawyer. Yale, Oxford, Harvard, and then she went on to get her law degree. And she's in hot water. They're trying to get rid of her. And tenure is almost supposed to be like a superpower that prevents academics from being picked on when they're saying controversial things. But they're going after her. She's being supported by a few free speech organizations, and good for them, because some of the things she says are quite controversial. So she's having a big kind of fight for her career now. She's going to update us on that first, I hope, and then I want to talk about what actually has happened to her. So here is Dr. Amy Wax. Hi, Dr. Wax, how are you?
Good, thank you for having me.
Happy to have you. So I just gave a little summary about the situation you're in now. And I couldn't find anything. The last thing I could find was a New York Times article, which I kind of don't trust them anyway, and that was from, I think, a couple of months ago. So what is the latest on where you stand in trying to hang on to your gig at UPenn through these things that are happening?
Well, as the New York Times article said, my dean, the dean of my law school, a man named Ted Ruger, has filed formal charges against me, accusing me of so-called behavioral violations against the school, and requesting that the Faculty Senate levy major sanctions on me. That's sort of an ambiguous term, but it can include anything from a slap on the wrist to stripping me of tenure and firing me. And the next step would be to hold hearings on these complaints. And they have been tentatively scheduled for next month. I and my attorney have objected to that on multiple grounds. So we'll see when these hearings actually occur. But the Faculty Senate and the Dean seem determined to go ahead with these charges against me. And of course, they are all and entirely based on my speech, my opinions, my expression, what is supposed to be and has traditionally been completely protected by the faculty tenure contract and recognized as such. 95% of what they're accusing me of are statements I've made extramurally outside of school, in public statements, which have nothing to do with my teaching or my conduct towards my students. A report that was done a year ago found no evidence that I was biased against students or had exercised any bias in my treatment of them. And even notwithstanding that finding, they're still going ahead. And now they're accusing me of two or three statements that I allegedly made to students, like, you know, 15 years ago, which of course I can't even remember, and anyway, are not offensive. So they're kind of getting desperate in finding ways to ding me, as you can imagine. And that's where it stands. That's basically where it stands. We have a whole laundry list of accusations, statements or phrases that have been taken out of context. My dean accusing me of every sin imaginable, racism, sexism, xenophobia, white supremacy, bigotry, white nationalism, anti-immigration feelings and expressions. A very kind of scattershot, rat-a-tat, typical woke set of charges. That's really what I'm facing at Penn at this point.
So I just want to just clarify, though, that so they are they trying to fire you? Is that the end result of all the stuff they're doing? They just want you off campus, not paying you anymore? Or are they offering you a settlement that you're not taking? I'm just sort of wondering what the dynamic is for you personally right now.
Well, they have not offered me any settlement at all. They seem determined. I'm not sure what the end point is for them because they've been very coy about it. They haven't said, well, our goal is to fire you. That is what we aim to do. The dean did say a few years ago in a secret meeting with students, it really sucks that Amy Wax is still a professor here. I'm doing my very best to change that. You know, there are procedures and hoops I have to jump through. So that's about as close as he got to promising the students that he would get rid of me. But personally, I mean, I think all the signals are there that they would love to fire me if they thought they could get away with it. And there's a broader agenda here, Trish. And the agenda is to dismantle and take down our legal system, our legal institutions, including our schools, our law schools, our venerable law schools, to take it all down, lock, stock, and barrel, because it is oppressive, it is corrupt, it represents white supremacy, there's nothing good about it. And I, in dissenting from the orthodoxy of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the woke progressive narrative that is the only acceptable one in the universities and schools right now, I represent a threat. So one piece of that bigger project is to get rid of me and people like me and make sure that we are not protected by the ordinary mechanisms that have in the past allowed a diversity, a very broad range of views to be expressed in the higher education space. Academia is being turned over to radical left elements, and they are in the process of consolidating their power over higher education.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt. I've been, I don't know if you listened to hour one, but, you know, I've been on a bit of a rant around the trans issue. And
well, that's
a lot
part
of
it.
That's part of it, because it's coming out of the universities. Like the billboard, Chris actually said to me, well, you know, when I go to these rallies and people are attacking me or yelling at me, a lot of them are women, which is actually, they're not, it's not women generally. It's university students. It's young women who've been brainwashed, you know, into believing some of the more extreme nonsense about trans. And it's all coming out of the universities. And I, well, you heard me talking about J school, same thing. Like we, you know, if you want to bring down a society, corrupt their information gathering process. And that's what the journalism schools are doing now too. So I totally get where you're coming from. And I want to kind of explore that in a minute. But I just want to ask you this. Would you take a settlement if they offered you one? I understand you've got a health issue, which you're free to talk about or not if you choose. Because I heard you say it in another podcast, so I thought it was okay to bring it up. But
well, it very much would depend on what it was. I mean, I've been made no secret of the fact that I would never apologize. That couldn't possibly be any part of a settlement. Yeah. I would never accept any term that would limit what I say or how I say it. I would not want to be in any financial hole because I've done nothing wrong. So I would not accept any net penalty in terms of finances because I've spent a ton of money on legal fees, and
oh,
of course it's been a very, yeah, very stressful experience for me. I accept that as part of the package and part of the price for what I'm doing, which I think is absolutely worth it. I think I am fighting the existential threat of the woke takeover of the university. But if they wanted, you know, some minor sanction, they would have to propose something. I would have to think about it, but you know, there are limits beyond which I absolutely would not go. So you know, but they don't seem interested at all in any kind of settlement. They seem to want to fight this to the death, which is kind of ridiculous. They've hired outside counsel, which I'm sure they're paying, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to. They've hired a high-priced law firm, which, frankly, between you and me, is not very good. And the partner they have working on this is kind of a dope, actually. but they think it's worth it. I can't explain it. You know, they want to get rid of this little old lady in the corner office. They think of her as some monstrous threat. And here's the thing. Here's what it boils down to. They want the rule to be, okay, that if you upset or offend or discomfit any student, and especially any special status minority students, you know, these sacred individuals who get special privileges, and they do, right? By anything you say or do, then you're unfit to teach and they can fire you. Now, if you think about that rule for a minute, right, it just takes a total wrecking ball to academic freedom. I mean, what's left when the ultimate arbiter is, you know, will some 18-year-old or 22-year-old be, you know, caught off guard or emotionally discomfited or offended somehow, or, you know, finds disagreeable something that you said, and that's it. That's good enough, right? Then it's over for you. That is the new dispensation that they are pushing. It's in the charges. You know, nothing derogatory, nothing upsetting, nothing offensive. Well, you know, the First Amendment and free speech can't survive that rule. That's a heckler's veto. That's what the Supreme Court has called it. And by any other name, that's what it is. Right? The person who's upset, they make the rules.
Well, that is exactly what has been happening in other areas of employment too, right? We had up here a news anchor with a pretty good reputation, a woman I knew quite well. I worked with her, Wendy Mesley, very smart, very beautiful, very experienced, who used the N-word not kind of as a descriptor or anything in normal conversation, but rather quoting someone else who'd used the word. So it was for a news, they were talking about a news story or something, right? And it might have been indelicate. I don't even know how to look at those things anymore, but it wasn't, she wasn't being racist, but it upset a very, very junior person in her office who complained about her. And let me tell you something, they hung her out to dry in a way that absolutely scared me to death, that this a young person who kind of has no power in a newsroom. They shouldn't have power. They're there to learn stuff from the older people, like I did back in the day. I'm like an old crank now, right? I had to learn things. But it gives it affords people who don't know enough a lot of power that is wielded in a very, very angry and destructive way. We got a break. I want to talk more about that when we come back. This is TNT Radio. I'm Trish Wood with Dr. Amy Wax. Back in a moment.
You should hear what Alan Miller is talking about.
It seems to me that many people think that you can't really ever assess or evaluate anything scientifically, because on the one hand, there's things that are lied about or talked, and on the other hand, is it even possible to have an objective account of what's happened? I mean, how do you see that, first of all?
Well, I mean, you know, in a sense, yeah, that's what we have done instead is, rather than form a judgment about scientific fact, form a judgment about how, if you like, a discourse of science was developed, and the political framework of that, and the dimension of power and politics and of economic interests which have shaped the way in which what we call the COVID consensus emerged. So those are quite different things. But we do also say, you know, on the more kind of hotter topics like masking, vaccines, those kind of things, our interest is really around the way in which the economic and political frameworks produce the outcome that we saw, and how that is completely contrary to the scientific method.
Alan Miller and today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
When the forgotten poor are suffering and in need of healing, they wait for a ship unlike any other. Mercy Ships, the largest floating civilian hospital in the world, with volunteer medical staff and crew who donate their time to save lives. Heroes of mercy, like these.
Every human being has the right to be treated as human, to have a place at the table of the human race.
If you could just see the look in the patient's eyes or the smiles that you get when lives have been changed, then it would make it all worth it.
We bring hope and healing to one person, but that person belongs to a family, and that family belongs to a community.
Together, these heroes of mercy and friends like you bring hope and healing to those who desperately need it.
Thank you!
Thank you!
To learn more about Heroes of Mercy, go to mercyships.org today.
The conversation continues.
We chose not to vaccinate our children because we feel like the shot posed more threat than the disease.
On today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, everybody. Trish Wood here on The Fringe with Dr. Amy Wax, who is being, it really sounds like, kind of hung out to dry, to use a crude phrase, by UPenn, where she is a law professor, tenured, highly, highly educated and esteemed in her field. And we were just talking about, we had a case here of a news anchor who was publicly kind of shunned and punished for using the N-word in front of someone who was upset by it. But it was not, she wasn't using the word as a, she was quoting someone else who used it in a news context. And it should have been settled differently is the point I'm trying to make. It became a huge deal. She had to do one of those kind of like mea culpa, awful posts about it, which I would not have done, by the way. Instead of maybe getting Wendy and the person whose feelings were hurt into a room together and letting her make a gentle apology. Because I know she didn't, I know that Wendy didn't mean anything by it, but it always has to be a big hoo-ha now, right? It always, everybody's grandstanding about how, you know, how great they are at policing the way we're supposed to think. And I think in part that's what's happening here.
Well, I mean, the incident that you just described, I would have a very different take on it. I mean, here we have someone quoting another person, and I assume she was quoting for to make a point or a purpose, using the N-word, not using it as a direct epithet. And to even be offended by that is irrational and thoughtless and mindless and immature, and it's probably one of the least knowledgeable and, you know, experienced people in your office. That person is allowed to become hysterical and make a fuss. That to me is no warrant for any kind of apology. I'll tell you what is a warrant for: someone in authority to exercise their authority and their greater wisdom to pull that person aside and say, I'm sorry, but your response is not appropriate. It's thoughtless, it's mindless, it's hysterical. And this is why the fuss you're making is disruptive to our workplace. The problem here and the problem in the areas that I operate in, academia, school, higher ed, is that the people in authority who should be instructing these very inexperienced and frankly ignorant younger people in appropriate behavior and why their little tantrums shouldn't be thrown, right? They have just run for the hills. They have completely abdicated. Yeah. They have turned the asylum over to the inmates. There are always going to be silly, inexperienced people who throw tantrums. That's just goes with the territory. And what we need is other individuals to correct them, to admonish them, not to apologize to them, not to try to assuage their irrational reactions and emotions, their hysterical, unjustified responses, really quite the opposite. And that is not what I'm seeing, certainly where I operate.
Well, we also saw that when Barry Weiss wrote that great letter and left the New York Times, because that was about Tom Cotton writing. He was writing an op-ed about something. I think it was about Black Lives Matter and whether they should bring in the National Guard or something. But what went around the office, everybody was working from home. It was high COVID times, right? And it went around everybody in the office with the kind of a more woke sensibility and obviously a sympathy for Black Lives Matter. And they really went after her hard in a way that was completely unprofessional. And I'm thinking, like, where is the boss of those people? Why are those angry young people, and I'm sure some of them weren't so young, but caught up in the hysteria of this kind of woke psychological crisis that's infecting everything? No one was standing for Barry, and they were saying terrible things about her online and being mean to her. I mean, it's just like ridiculous. Like where are the grownups, right? That's what I want to say now. Where are the grownups? And there doesn't seem to be too many left.
Right. And I think the word unprofessional is a really apt word, a really good word. And I'm glad you said it, because in the past, that kind of hysteria, hysterical, unthinking reaction, and then attempting to conscript everybody into yeah. that personal hysteria would be considered completely unprofessional. And the grown-ups would have taken care of it, or at least taken this person aside and tried to, you know, put some sense into them. But that doesn't happen now. I think the people in charge are afraid of the social justice warrior types. I'm not entirely sure why that is. I think what it really boils down to, and what, you know, this whole wokeism business boils down to, is just an obsession with race and identity, and this grievous fear of being accused of racism, which, of course, accusing someone of racism is the easiest thing in the world that you could possibly do. You just trot out those terms and those labels and those accusations, and, you know, you're in charge. We shouldn't allow that to happen, but it's motivated by fear, and the fear is, it's pretty pathetic, actually. You know, getting over the fear of being called a racist is very, very liberating. I can attest to that.
Well, it's interesting because people say to me now, how does Western, I feel like Western culture and society is dying. I feel like this is kind of fall of Rome 2.0 for a variety of reasons. But I think it's because of a toxic information pool a little before COVID and then during, but during COVID made us all a bit crazy, and now it seems to be really accelerating on a whole bunch of fronts. But I feel like I'm not sure it's fixable now. I kind of feel like that's where we are, and we're going downhill. And I think the more that we are instructed by these people to believe things that aren't true and see things that aren't there and bow to things that aren't worth our attention, or out of fear of some kind of penalty, the more disabling it is for our culture. I think it's really bad for us. And I have a thing that I say now, which is, you know, I'll meet you citizen to citizen and respectfully, but I'm not wearing any of your monikers. I'm not. I'm going to criticize extreme transism. I'm going to criticize this and that. And if you're going to throw something at me, that's cool. But I'm not accepting it. I'm not apologizing. And I'm not going to meet you there. We're not doing that anymore. And I think people have to stand up and say that. And if I inadvertently hurt someone's feelings, you know, I'll apologize. But let's stop with the hysteria and the name calling. Or we will be finished. Maybe they want us to be finished. I don't know. But we will be finished if this keeps going on.
Well, I mean, mob rule is very hard to tame, as you know. This is really what this is. But it precedes COVID. It's been gaining momentum and gaining strength for a long time. And it's the convergence of a lot of different trends in our society. One of them is this kind of postmodern perverse tendency to turn hostility and hatred on oneself and one's own culture, which I honestly can say that, you know, in the West, in the United States, in the Anglosphere, I don't completely understand, because I think that we have brought so many good things to life worldwide. And of course, we are emulated and admired for those things, it's hard to justify and explain why all this self-hatred. It does start from the top, you know. It starts with white people hating themselves, but of course it gains a lot of support and momentum from our society's so-called diversity. So we bring in people from outside that society, from outside Western society. They also join the chorus of hating what we are, hating who we are, encouraged by people who are part of our society. Put those two factions together, and you've got this overwhelming mob that seems to be taking on a life of its own. But I'll tell you this, I think that if you do not make a special effort to preserve, protect, and defend what we in the West have achieved for all our flaws and all our faults, then we will lose what we have achieved. We are already losing it. And in order to preserve, protect, and defend what we have built, and what we have built has many, many virtues and glories, we have to revere it, we have to respect it, we have to admire it, and we have to tell the truth about it. So, you know, lie is piling upon lie about what the West is, its nature, what it's like. There is a exclusive focus on and dwelling on the negatives, the sins, the depredations, the exploitation, and almost nothing taught to our young people about our glorious achievements. That's considered chauvinism or, you know, white yeah. supremacy or something, which is crazy, absolutely crazy. And because of that, the young people are going to harbor this delusion that, you know, iPhones fall from the sky. Prosperity just kind of grows on trees. I don't know. They don't really understand what it takes to maintain the enviable, peaceable societies that the West has built, and not understanding it, not understanding what it takes, I'm afraid they are going to lose it.
I heard somebody say, somebody really smart said, I forget where, but they said that the generation that's in school now that's trying to tear down the culture in which they live, the society in which they live, is going to wake up under some kind of weird Marxist dystopian nightmare, not being able to have nice things anymore and wonder how the hell it happened. But I don't know how we deprogram those people. I really don't. But let's go to a break. And then I'm going to ask you something maybe you want a minute to think about too for when we come back. If you've said anything that you've been criticized for that you actually regret or wish that you hadn't said, don't answer now because we're going to go to a break. We'll be back with Dr. Amy Wax back in a mo.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
There is a big El Nino coming on. Looks like it's going to be strong. I don't know if it's going to be a super Nino, but it looks like it's certainly going to be the strongest since 2015 and 2016. And of course, that's going to have major implications globally as far as the weather goes. Now, usually when El Ninos show up, the Atlantic hurricane season goes down. But I've never seen sea surface temperatures this warm in front of an El Nino in the Atlantic basin. In fact, the entire ocean is warming up at what I consider a rate that can only be accomplished by the input of geothermal energy from the bottom of the ocean. But this particular year, when I look at the Atlantic hurricane season, I'm saying, well, this is not so easy as normal. And it may wind up that even though there may be less than normal activity in the Caribbean and into the islands, further north for the United States, there still could be real trouble. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
Tell me about it. Did you have any idea that was going on?
None. I mean, you saw Derek at the game last night too. Did you have a clue?
No, but you know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do. Kids hear first about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
It can be hard to tell sometimes, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, bullying, violence, anything, you need to tell an adult. Mom or me, a teacher, coach, school counselor, someone you know and trust.
Dad, no kid is gonna tell an adult about that kind of stuff.
I get it, but if we don't know, we can't help. Speaking up about a problem, that's what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT with Trish Wood.
Yes, that is me, and I am back with Dr. Amy Wax, a law professor at UPenn who is fighting to save her tenured position there. She's being investigated after complaints of her saying things that were deemed racist and other things. And I just before the break, I asked you if there's anything you regret that you did, not the stuff they've accused you of saying that they're not proving, but the like you said on something on Glenn Lowry about the heart of liberty and Asian chess or something. And I went, ooh, when I heard that, my feeling was like, uh-oh. Do you regret saying that or anything like that?
There's no views that I've expressed or opinions that I've expressed that I regret, in the sense that I stand by everything I've said. Now, I'm perfectly happy to have people, and people have, disagreed with me or tried to refute me or sent me messages or letters or emails in which they've taken issue with what I've said, and that's fine. I mean, that's part of, you know, what I would expect, because many views are the opening of a conversation and a discussion. That's very appropriate. What I've, you know, done is I've really tried to broaden the sorts of views that people are exposed to, because frankly, they are part and parcel of our conversations outside of academia. I mean, academia has this stylized narrative that is so narrow and gray. And when you go out there in the real world and talk to ordinary people in their living rooms or kitchens or an ordinary conversation, they are saying a lot of the things that I've been saying, or at least they're concerned about them. They're willing to listen to them and entertain them. That's the real world. Academia right now bears no resemblance to the real world. Now, I regret is maybe using some phrases which the yellow journalism of the day can kind of lift out of context, you know, and try to tar me with. There are certain things that if I'd maybe said them a little differently, I wouldn't have given them as easy a piece of fodder, right?
For
Distorted little dishonest narratives, which really are deplorable. I mean, the state of journalism right now is
it's
shameful. It's
the worst.
I could give you a million examples, right? I mean, the New York Times, it isn't fit to line a birdcage with, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, listen, I'm with you. I mean, look at, they spent, you know, like four years accusing President Trump of colluding with Russia. Everything, I mean, they won Pulitzer Prizes for it. And the story was wrong. It was a lie. So what
is irony here? Which is, people are saying, what you say is offensive and it's really upsetting us. We can't learn, given that you've said these things. Well, you know, I'm offended every single day of the week when I open up the New York Times and read some of the stories that I read, which I know are half-truths or sins of omission or, you know, outright lies. And nobody cares that I'm offended. I'm not trying to get anybody fired because they wrote something that, you know, upsets me or if it's distasteful to me. People on the right have to experience this all the time, and they think nothing of it. This is democracy. It's unfortunate. I don't regret anything I've said, and I don't apologize for anything I said. That doesn't mean I'm right about everything. I mean, there are people who actually reach out to me and want to talk about it. And then there are other people that just send emails that, you know, I can't even read on this program, because they're just insult after insult, profanity after profanity, saying anti-Jewish things, misogynistic things, you're an old hag, using sexualized terms. I mean, how does this contribute to the conversation? It doesn't.
I was called an old bat the other day by someone I had an argument with on the street about not having their dog leashed. And I actually thought, that's really
far worse. I've been called far worse.
Well, I hadn't heard that expression in like 40 years or something ever uttered by anybody. So I thought, wow, that's kind of retro. That's interesting. Anyway, I get what you're saying. And I think we all have to inoculate ourselves from the idea of being so thin-skinned that if somebody says something a little off, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, everybody said off stuff all the time. They were perfectly lovely people. They didn't mean any harm. And now I would say maybe they shouldn't have said those things that they said. But people weren't so thin-skinned. And now people are taught to be thin-skinned. People who might not be offended by a comment have been conditioned to think that some of these things, when they're said, are the worst thing, like the girl with Wendy Mesley, or some of the people who may have complained about something you've said, if in fact that actually happened in the school, or I don't know if there's evidence of that, or if they're saying, I think you're quibbling with some of those things, aren't you?
Well, you know, I'm all for good manners, and I think that that how one should speak about things is very much context dependent. But yeah. When you're trying to grapple with issues of policy and political issues and questions of the day, then you have to be blunt. It's really important. And people, right, cannot be thin-skinned. We cannot have a viable democracy which requires us to tolerate, even grudgingly tolerate, people that disagree with us drastically. If we take offense at every little thing, and our offense is front and center rather than grappling with the underlying pros and cons, because that's what democracy requires, right? So people have to really toughen up. That you cannot have a viable democracy unless people toughen up and learn to listen to and somehow deal with individuals that drastically differ from them in their opinions, their outlook, their life orientation. That is what tolerance is. Tolerance is hard. It's very, very hard. And that's why it's so unfortunate that we're not training our children up to that very hard thing.
Did you watch the birth of this in the Evergreen college tapes? Have you seen those tapes with Brett Weinstein in them back when this kind of all helped?
Very familiar. The same sort of thing happened at Yale, what the Christakis's, you know, students whining about how unsafe they feel, how upset they are, how psychologically traumatized they are. Of course, none of this is on the merits. This is all a substitute for students learning how to make an argument, marshal evidence, get at the truth. These are all hard work, very hard work. It's the hard work of learning and of democracy, yeah, and of living together with people who don't see eye to eye. And that hard work is not getting done. I can tell you that. It is not getting
done.
Well,
I think it's not getting done. It's a bit of a perfect storm, isn't it? Like the coddling of the American mind kind of meets wokeism. So you have this kind of cohort of kids who have been so spoiled and coddled, they can't think for themselves. And if one little thing is painful, they go nuts because it's the end of the world. I mean, that's kind of what set this up to happen here, isn't it? I want to just, before we run out of time, we've got about like 8 minutes left. You say something I find really interesting. I do call myself a feminist, a kind of a self-styled old school feminist. But I'm also equally able to say that there are some things I think that groups of women in the world are doing badly. And you said, I love this, that the feminization of universities is one of the things driving this craziness. And when you said it, I thought, you know what? That feels true to me. What quality do you think it is in some groups of women, especially these women academics who are driving the wokeism and gender theory and critical race theory and all the garbage? What quality, if in fact it is a feminine quality, do you think it is that drives this into the schools through women profs and young female students?
Well, I mean, I have called it in the past the values of the kindergarten and the nursery, right? The values kindergarten and the nursery and the hearth and the home, which are the traditional purviews of female operation, yeah, right, which feminism is trying to broaden, of course. Those are values that say nurture, care, feelings, encouragement, making people feel good about themselves, the emotional climate, ensuring that no one is emotionally hurt or in any way traumatized and feels very welcome and happy at all times. Those are feminine values. Those are the values that dominate in those spheres and are actually in some respects appropriate to those spheres, right? The values of nurture and care. But the values of nurture and care have not traditionally been at the forefront of the academic enterprise, which is devoted to discovering truth, examining evidence, creating new knowledge, exploring ideas, assessing ideas, sort of intellectual debate and sparring, and a sportsmanlike approach to that, which is the acceptance of competition and adversative type of processes, differences that are resolved through this very elaborate set of conventions and rules. And then, of course, at the close of which we all go out and have a beer. So we don't take stuff personally. We don't take it to heart. And we tolerate a good deal of bruising criticism. Bruising criticism just goes with the territory. And we have to tolerate that in order to see through to those values. And when men controlled the space of academia, those values dominated. I, in some ways, fault men for ceding too much authority to women as they come into the system and the university. In a way, it was sort of hard not to, because demography is destiny. As more and more women come in, they have the votes, they're put in positions of control, their values start to supersede and supplant the values that were there before. And academia is a self-governing institution. So it's very hard to stop this. But I think that men should have tried harder to stop it. They should have stood up and said, we don't like what's happening. We think it's destructive. We think that it will undermine the academic enterprise in the long run, which it has done and it is in the process of doing. And I think that our great universities are, you know, slowly eroding on all sorts of fronts. And as Hemingway said, it's happening gradually, but then it will happen suddenly.
Like bankruptcy. Isn't that what he was talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
I bet people just hate it when you say that about the feminization of universities, because there is a bunch of people who think this is a great, great triumph. And in, I suppose in some way it is, but it wasn't until I read you saying that, that I did fully, fully understand what is happening here, because those avenues of study, the ones that I find really, really frightening, are dominated by female academics, aren't they? It's scary.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, female emancipation was sort of part and parcel of modernity and civil rights. And, you know, that has many upsides. It's given women more opportunity, more choice. And of course, there have been women, I would never deny this, who have contributed because they've been given the opportunity to contribute. But I think it's also had tremendous downsides, and the downsides have been allowed to run riot. I mean, to dominate. And I just wish and I hope, and maybe it's wishful thinking, that you know, wouldn't have happened, wouldn't have been allowed to happen. Once again, I fault men for, and you know, tough-minded women for giving into it. And I don't see that trend abating or slowing down, maybe a little bit. I mean, you know, what happened at Stanford and at Stanford Law School offers the tiniest little bit of reason for hope. But it's, you know, one point of light in a very dark sea.
But that woman, I've forgotten her name, the diversity prof or whatever the heck she was. What a nightmare. I mean, she was a nightmare. I mean, it was like I was watching theater. I couldn't believe an academic at an august school like Stanford could behave the way, although I should.
I mean, there are hundreds of people just like her. I mean, there's a little place in hell that turns these people out, a factory. And they've just been allowed, they've been hired everywhere, and they have an agenda. Here's the thing. In order to go back to a robust sense of freedom of thought and freedom of expression in the university, it is absolutely necessary to get rid of each and every diversity, inclusion, and equity officer. You would have to completely dismantle that whole
apparatus. It's a grift. And every corporation, I have friends who work in these corporations, and they're calling me to say, well, we got to wear like a purple shirt today for this marginalized community. And the corporations are telling people what they got. I mean, one of the things I love about being an independent podcaster is I don't have to put up with that. This is a grift. It's a total grift. But
It's a apparatus, it's a bureaucracy, enormous, expensive, and powerful, which is there to enforce a particular ideology and to punish and exclude people who challenge that ideology and do not pay fealty to it. Right? And you're
and
right.
Shunning, right? Okay, we got to go, Dr. Wax, but I hope things work out for you in a way that is good. And I'm grateful for your appearance here today. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Bye.